someone needed to call out this ludicrous statement and stand up for funny women and minorities. And I knew the perfect writer to do it, a serious white male journalist named Nick Kristoff. Nick and I were college classmates, and I'd recently heard him give a book talk in L.A. about Half the Sky, which he co-wrote with Cheryl Wudun. Nick had a huge platform at the New York Times, and I trusted him completely. I emailed him, and he called me back from an airport. I pitched him the story. He listened, then paused. "Okay, my first question is this," he said. "Why aren't you writing the article, Nell?" "Because you write about women and people will listen to you," I said. What I didn't say was, "Because I'm scared to death." I knew speaking up would bring me both attention and criticism. It felt safer to hide behind Nick. He wouldn't let me. "It's your story," Nick said. "There's no one who will tell it better." I didn't want to. I even emailed a friend who worked on the show to say that I wasn't going to write anything. It was like announcing to my family that I was no longer going to eat refined sugar. That night, I couldn't put the thought out of my head. When I exited the show, I had kept my mouth shut because I was young and professionally vulnerable. Now I was in a different place. Dave's admission had triggered a full-blown existential crisis. In the four stages joke, the final, "Who is Nell Scovell?" is asked by studio executives who no longer recognize the name. Now I turned the question on myself. Who was I? What did I stand for? It's hard to describe, but I felt a compulsion to speak out. I considered the downsides. Dave was a towering figure in television, and I might never work for CBS or any network again. It helped that I just signed a 2-year contract at Warehouse 13, which gave me a little job security. I was reminded of a great line attributed to TV writer Tom Palmer. "I don't have fuck you money, but I do have I don't like your tone of voice money." My note to my friend on the show turned out to be as effective as my declarations not to eat refined sugar. The next morning, I grabbed a glazed chocolate donut and started crunching data. The numbers would prove that the gender disparity in 2009 was not a fluke, but a pattern. In 27 years, Late Night, Late Show, had hired only 7 female writers compared to over 100 male writers. And the men stayed longer. There were individual white male writers who had worked on the show for a decade longer than all the women's tenures combined. I later learned that female stand-ups were also underrepresented on the show. From 2005 to 2010, The Late Show booked approximately 96 stand-up performances. Women only appeared 5 times. Sexual favoritism is an important subject, but my article pivoted to the lack of diversity in the writer's room. Our country boasted 3 female Supreme Court justices, while Letterman, Leno, and Conan couldn't find a single woman good enough for their staffs. Burnett and other male head writers have suggested that women and people of color just don't apply for these jobs. That's victim blaming. The real problem was the hiring process often relied on current, white, male writers recommending their funny, white male friends to be future, white male writers. And I knew from personal experience that when women did apply, they were often ignored. 9 months before the blackmail scandal broke, I heard Late Night was looking for monologue writers who could work remotely. Recalling Dave's words that I was always welcome back, I submitted 4 pages of jokes. The submission got sucked into a black hole. Soon after, I sold a pilot to ABC and got busy with that. Still, the show's silence suggested that they were happier complaining about the lack of female applicants than actually responding to them. I finished a draft of my article and ran it by many wise and funny friends, including Suzanne Daniels, Amy Hone, J.J. Jameson, Kurt Anderson, Ann Kramer, and Tim Carvell. They all offered helpful advice and encouragement. Finally, I sought approval from one more person. The previous summer, Our 11-year-old son had gone to a one-week camp at a local school. After the first day, Dexter came back raving about a funny camper named Jake. I pressed him to get Jake's last name so we could make a play date. Dexter came back 2 days later. "Jake's last name is Brooks, and his dad's a director," he said. "Alfred Brooks." "Wait, do you mean Albert Brooks?" "Yeah, that's it."
"Oh, we made a play date."
By that October, I felt comfortable enough to share the draft with Albert and his wildly talented writer-artist wife, Kimberly. I told him that I was still on the fence about speaking out publicly. "Oh, you have to publish this," Kimberly said after she read the piece. Albert looked more pensive. "No one can argue with what you've written," he said deliberately. "It's been my experience that a fairer sampling of humanity will always produce better comedy." I felt chills. "Albert, that's perfect. Can I use that line?"
"Sure."
Albert understood that shows should hire female writers, not just because it's the right or fair thing to do, but because it would make these shows funnier. And he practiced what he preached. Albert wrote Defending Your Life by himself, but other times he teamed up with Monica Johnson. Together they co-wrote Modern Romance and Lost in America. Both these films have female characters who are flawed and funny. Julie Haggerty gambling away the nest egg is something Monica might have done herself. To be clear, I don't believe only women can write women and only men can write men. The craft for any writer is getting inside a character's head and understanding their fears, their joys, and their motivations. Emotions are universal, but experiences are not. At Warehouse 13, I wrote an episode where Micah, the female lead, becomes magically pregnant. I included a beat in the outline about Micah's sense of smell becoming acute. On the notes call, an executive questioned the detail. "I don't get the smelling," he said. "Is that like a thing?"
"Yes," I said.
Then it struck me that of the 7 people on the call, I was the only one who'd ever been pregnant. Different backgrounds generate different experiences. A room that shuts out half the population, as well as people of color and the LGBTQ community, will have less material to work with. I added Albert's line, and after a final pass from my invaluable editor, Mike Hogan, the piece was scheduled to post. I contacted my soon-to-be boss, Jack Kenny, and my agent, Jill Gillette, to let them know that Letterman and Me would go live the next day. Jack and Jill were both supportive, which helped tremendously. The next morning, I opened my laptop. My inbox was flooded. I closed my laptop. I made breakfast for the kids and walked them to school. As soon as I returned home, the phone rang. "Hi, is this Nell? I'm a producer at the Today Show. We read your article and want you to come on the show tomorrow."
I said, unprepared for the call.
"We'll fly you to New York, and you'd appear in studio with Matt Lauer himself." TV Morning News loves a sex scandal, and even though my article didn't offer any juicy details, it would serve to keep the story alive.
"I need to think about that," I said.
My next call was to check in with Mike Hogan at Vanity Fair. There were other offers to appear on news and talk shows, and we discussed how it could be good to get more exposure. Still, I worried about losing control of the narrative. Mike said I should do what made me comfortable. I called the Today producer back. "I'm sorry," I said. "I'm going to pass." I opened my laptop and saw that my article had been picked up by several websites. All my friends had warned me not to read the comments. I ignored them. Some commenters dismissed me as a fame whore and not funny. Ah, the classics. Someone else linked to an article by Rachel Sklar with the promising headline, "Nell Scovell is my new hero." "Is Scovell as funny as any guy?" "Presumably, given her record," Rachel wrote. "So this isn't some screed born of years of pent-up frustration. It's measured and thoughtful and matter-of-factly assesses the situation." Rachel Sklar was my new hero. Men were angry, but women got it.
mostly. An East Coast friend emailed that they had just discussed me on The View, and Barbara Walters had accused me of setting women back by quitting. That stung. My phone rang.
Nell?
Hi, this is Matt Lauer. My producer tells me that you don't want to come on the show, and I was hoping to change your mind.
Matt was smooth and charming. He walked me through why I should accept his offer to tell my side of the story.
The problem, I explained, is that people want to hear about interns in the bedroom, and I want to talk about gender in the writer's room.
We can talk about anything you want, Matt said.
So you're okay if I don't discuss Dave sleeping with interns?
Hey, I couldn't be held to that high a standard, Matt said with a chuckle.
Matt's joke made me queasy. With apologies, I passed a second time. The only show I agreed to appear on was the Joy Behar show, since Joy had stuck up for me on The View. Before heading to the L.A. studio, I called Lawrence O'Donnell, who I knew through Penn Jillette, and asked for some TV interview tips.
Figure out the 3 points you want to make, Lawrence said, and if you're lucky, you'll get to make one of them.
Joy was smart and sympathetic. Before the cameras rolled, she mentioned that she'd been trying to get booked to do stand-up on Late Show for years without success. The segment sped by so quickly that I can't remember if I made my 1 point or not. The afternoon that my article came out, the Vanity Fair PR department received an email from legendary New York Daily News gossip columnist George Rush. He was publishing an exclusive item the next day and looking for a comment. Rush's scoop quoted an anonymous, long-time male Late Show staffer who said my article had been greeted with grumbling. Then the brave, anonymous staffer slimed me, claiming that during my tenure, I didn't get any jokes on the air and that I quit because I was going to be fired. I forwarded the quote to Steve O'Donnell, the head writer from my era, and asked if he remembered it that way. He emailed me back. I know that you got picked up at the end of that first stretch, so you obviously were satisfactory. And as I recall, you had only just started that second stretch when you gave notice. It struck me as ironic that after describing how I felt demeaned by the show in 1990, the show's knee-jerk response was to demean me again. In a way, their lies proved my point better than I could. I kept my response to George Rush short. The Late Show can say anything they want about me. Just hire more women. When the Daily News item ran the next day, the Vanity Fair lawyer sent a letter, pointing out the claim that I'd left before I got fired was false and slanderous. That sentence was removed from the online version. Late Show female staffers still working in the Ed Sullivan Theater wrote me on the sly to say they hoped the piece would trigger a confidential external investigation. It didn't. Worldwide Pants conducted their own internal review and, surprise, found no wrongdoing. Other employees, former and current, sent me nightmare stories of hostile treatment, and I encouraged them to speak out. None felt secure enough to do so. What makes me sad is that so many women in Hollywood don't want to talk about these issues because they're afraid of seeming like pains in the ass, a funny female friend emailed me. I went to a recent panel discussion for women TV writers, and someone asked the question about whether it was harder to be a woman in this business, and one of the four panelists actually said she thought it was easier. The rest soft-pedaled about whether it made a difference. It felt like Stockholm Syndrome to me, an ingrained eagerness to appeal to the system that keeps us down. I know that we don't want to feel like victims, and it's important not to dwell on the negative. And perhaps these women's experiences have been different. But really? I know that instinct to gloss over the bad. A week after the article posted, I ran into a woman at a party who'd worked on the production side in the early days of Jimmy Kimmel Live. She described at length how she dreaded going into the office. No matter how I dressed, my coworkers commented on my body, she said. I felt sexually harassed every single day. The environment stressed her out tremendously, and she told me that the second she got another job offer, she took it. Suddenly, she caught herself sounding negative and pivoted hard. "But I'm really grateful for the opportunity they gave me," she added quickly. Because women are so often excluded from these boys' clubs, it's still perceived as a favor when one is allowed in. And no matter how dreadful the conditions are, women are expected to be grateful. I think this explains why several Late Show writers reacted with so much anger toward me. Not a single male writer has disputed the validity of my criticisms. They simply believe that by pointing out the show's flaws, I didn't demonstrate the proper gratitude for the exceptional opportunity bestowed on me. The buzz over the article died down quickly. I even attended a meeting where an executive brought it up and didn't know that I'd written it. Who is Nell Scovell? In action. The Warehouse 13 writers' room started up in early November, and that was a welcome diversion. I was happy and grateful to go to work each day. I was the sole woman on the writing staff that season, but what else was new? Most of my coworkers had read the article. Some thought it was cool, especially story editor Ian Stokes, who told me he'd heard them discussing me on the Howard Stern show. "Artie Lang said he'd do you," Ian told me excitedly. As a longtime Stern listener, I felt honored. Other coworkers seemed a bit wary. Once, someone made a sexist comment in the room, and another writer cautioned him, "Be careful, or Nell will write an exposé about you." "Oh, yeah," I said. 19 years from now, you are going to be so sorry you said that." There did seem to be a hint of feminism in the air that season. While trying to figure out who the big bad villain might be, David Simkins suggested a time-traveling H.G. Wells. We all oohed at his idea. Then Jack Kenny looked at me with a sparkle in his eye. "And what if H.G. Wells was a woman?" Jack said. "Yes," I replied. Jack's idea was inspired, and Helena G. Wells anchored the second season. Criticizing late-night TV blew up some old friendships and sparked some new ones. For me, there remained a lingering question. Had Dave read the article? I doubted it, since he was busy with a court case, mending his marriage, and still appearing nightly on TV. Still, if he had read the piece, what was his reaction? Was he furious? My job at late night had been to make Dave happy, so making him unhappy still felt wrong. I had a fantasy. One day, my phone rings. I answer it. "Hold for Dave," says one of Dave's 83 assistants. I brace myself for Dave to start yelling, because even in my own fantasy, people are mad at me. But instead, he thanks me. We have a long overdue conversation about including women and people of color in the writer's room. Dave agrees with everything I say, and we're joking and having a great time until I have to run because my dead mother is calling on the other line. Both those phone calls had the same odds of happening. I resigned myself to never having a clue about Dave's reaction. At this point, he was so isolated from the staff that a producer told me, "We only knew Dave was in the office when we saw him on the show." The Daily News item had included a quote from the anonymous male staffer stating, "Right now there's almost an affirmative action policy at the Late Show. Most likely the next job will go to a woman." The key word in that male staffer's sentence turned out to be almost. The next hire was another white male. When I heard the news, I slumped. My speaking up had no impact. It reminded me of this old Jewish joke. Life in the shtetl is good until one day there's a pogrom, and every man is lined up against a wall for the firing squad. The Cossacks aim their rifles, and the head Cossack says, "Before we open fire, does anyone have any last requests?" Shlomo raises his hand timidly and says, "As a matter of fact, I have a request." Then Jaime leans over and whispers, "Shh! Don't make trouble!" Maybe I should have listened to Jaime and kept my mouth shut. I didn't want to make trouble. I just wanted to make progress.
Chapter 16. The one I'd been waiting for. Man at Lean In Book Party. So you're the woman behind Sheryl Sandberg.
Me.
Yes, I'm behind Sheryl Sandberg and running as fast as I can to keep up.
I first laid eyes on Sheryl Sandberg when friends started emailing me the link to her 2010 TED Talk with subject lines like, "You have to watch this," or "Have you seen?"
I assumed her talk advised women to use multiple punctuation marks. The talk, "Why We Have Too Few Women Leaders," opened with Sheryl telling a story about attending a boardroom meeting where several women took seats on the side of the room until she waved them over to join her at the table. I flashed back to my first Newhart table read and how I, too, chose a chair on the periphery. I had believed this instinct stemmed from my natural timidity, but Sheryl made me realize that choice was instilled by our culture. Then she explained why it mattered.
"Boy, it matters a lot," Sheryl said, "because no one gets to the corner office by sitting on the side, not at the table, and no one gets the promotion if they don't think they deserve their success, or they don't even understand their own success." I was captivated. As the head of online sales and operations at Google, and then chief operating officer at Facebook, Sheryl had hired over 10,000 employees, which gave her a broad perspective. Her talk zoomed from the big picture to minute details, offering hard data and studies to support Sheryl's own conclusions. Sheryl connected the historical sweep of gender bias with individual decisions and then offered a way forward. Everything she said rang true. Over time, I had learned to sit at the table, literally and figuratively, but getting the corner office had brought a new set of obstacles. Sheryl unpacked the unsettling feelings I'd encountered when trying to lead. She said, "What the data shows, above all else, is that success and likability are positively correlated for men and negatively correlated for women. And everyone's nodding because we all know this to be true." How did she know I was nodding? This stranger was in my head. When I finished listening to Sheryl's video, I felt odd. Normally, a discussion about women in the workplace leaves me feeling agitated. Every few years, I used to get together for brunch with a group of upper-level female TV writer-producers, and we'd unload stories about the unfairness we'd encountered. I'd tell my story about the time I was renegotiating to stay on a show, and the executive producer stopped by my office to check on the deal.
"Did your agents call business affairs?" he asked.
"Yep, they're on it."
"And you don't care about money, right?"
I looked at my boss, incredulous.
"Yeah, I'm just here for the salty snacks," I said.
My favorite stories are ones where the sexism is blatant. As co-EP on a show, I was asked to rewrite the script of a low-level writer. I did a big pass over the weekend and then sent the new draft to the EP on Sunday night for a polish. The next morning, the EP pulled me aside.
"Great job, Nell," he said. "But if you don't mind, I think it's better if I tell Mike that I did the rewrite. I don't want him to feel emasculated."
The women at the brunch would gasp at these stories before telling their own gasp-inducing tales. And the stories would keep coming. And coming. By the time the frittata was served, the relief of realizing the bias wasn't personal was replaced by the horror of knowing it was so pervasive. I'd always leave the brunch feeling worse than when I arrived. But Sheryl's talk made me feel calmer. In 14 minutes, she had given me deep insight into my 25-year career without a single carb. I forwarded the video to other friends with my own multiple punctuation marks. I also sent Sheryl a friend request on Facebook. Around the time that I discovered Sheryl's talk, I started hearing some positive news about late-night staffing. Leno added a female writer to the Tonight Show staff, and Late Show with David Letterman added one too. And while there'd been hundreds of dads writing comedy for late night, I believe Lori Kilmartin holds the distinction of being the first mom when she joined Conan's staff in 2010. Work on Warehouse 13 continued. We had a strong season and finished as Sci-Fi's most-watched series. Over hiatus, I teamed up with Tim Carvel, now head writer, executive producer of Last Week Tonight, to write Backstabber, an update of All About Eve set in the fashion industry with a gay male assistant taking over the Eve Harrington role. The spec script is still available, as it appears we misjudged the market for a screenplay starring a woman in her 40s and a young gay man. Like many Americans in 2010, I started spending lots of time on Facebook. I'd been an early adopter, joining when you still needed a .edu address. Through the site, I reconnected with Elliot Schrage, a friend from college who was now running Facebook's media and communications. Elliot knew I worked in TV and reached out with some comedy-related questions. Should Mark Zuckerberg do a voice on The Simpsons? Yes. What if he doesn't love the pages they sent? Ask for new jokes. SNL wants Mark to do a cameo when Jesse Eisenberg is hosting. Do you have any ideas? Yes. The setup was Mark would stand with Lorne Michaels at the monitors and watch Jesse Eisenberg chat with cast member Andy Samberg. Both had impersonated Mark on screen. The money shot was all three Marks together, so it seemed obvious that the real Mark should want to join the two fakes. The conflict would be that Michaels doesn't think it's a good idea. I pitched this exchange. Mark, you leave me no choice. Mark pokes Lorne with a finger. Lorne, what are you doing? Mark, poking you. Lorne, that's so annoying. Mark, I know. I invented it. Mark shortened the pitch to a much snappier, I invented poking, and it got a big laugh. Writing occasional jokes for Mark Zuckerberg was a fun side project. Then in March 2011, Elliot sent an email asking if I'd seen Sheryl Sandberg's TED Talk. Seen it, I wrote back. I memorized it. I wrote him that Sheryl had shifted my perspective in a positive way, and my PS mentioned that I'd sent her a friend request but hadn't heard back. 5 minutes later, I smiled as a message flashed on my screen. Sheryl Sandberg has accepted your friend request. It was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Sheryl was set to deliver the Forrestal Lecture at the U.S. Naval Academy in April. She had a partial draft written in bullet points, but as a full-time COO and mother of two small children, she was looking for someone to pull the speech together and make it flow. Although I'd never written a serious speech before, I was eager to do anything to support her. She sent me her draft, which contained this bullet point. Get women to lean in, especially during the childbearing years. Find a way to get them to lean into their careers and give them the flexibility they need to stay in the workforce. Admiral Mullen spoke about the importance of this for the Navy at the White House earlier this year. This was Sheryl's first public mention of the phrase, lean in. Today, the term is so widely used that a friend recently asked me, what did we say before lean in? Speech writing came easily since it combines two skills I'd already developed. Like a magazine article, a speech needs to present an argument with a strong opening, a logical flow of ideas, and a thoughtful or uplifting conclusion. Like TV dialogue, the speaker needs to sound natural and have a consistent voice. Sheryl has off-the-charts charm, and her natural character combines three of my childhood heroes. She has the logic of Mr. Spock, the empathy of Dr. McCoy, and the leadership abilities of Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise. The Forrestal Lecture was followed by the 2011 Barnard Commencement Address. Again, Sheryl asked me to collaborate, and we considered what we would have wanted someone to tell us when we graduated from college. Sheryl said she wanted to give young women permission to be ambitious. Too often our culture discourages that. She also wanted to discuss how women unconsciously hold themselves back out of fear. I flashed back to my teen years when I'd listen to Barbara Streisand sing I'm the Greatest Star from Funny Girl over and over. I also idolized Bette Midler, who radiated confidence. She even dubbed herself the Divine Miss M. I didn't realize it at the time, but Bette and Barbara were modeling fearlessness and self-esteem. They were teaching me how to lean in. The day of the address, Cheryl was battling a cold and her voice was hoarse, but the force of her conviction never wavered. She encouraged the all-female graduating class to aim high and believe in themselves. Never let your fear overwhelm your desire, she urged at the end. So please ask yourself, what would I do if I weren't afraid? And then go do it. Watching a live stream of the speech in Santa Monica, I cheered along with the hundreds of new Barnard graduates. After Barnard, there was buzz about trying to reach a broader audience with a book. At a conference, WME, William Morris Endeavor, book agent extraordinaire Jennifer Rudolph Walsh followed Cheryl into the women's room to pitch the project. Books start conversations, Jennifer insisted. Cheryl had a packed schedule and couldn't see a way to fit in an additional major project. Then one day she called, excited. Jennifer just called me. She got an offer to write a book, and I think I want to do it. That's great. I told them I wouldn't do it without you. Are you in? A wave of fear hit me. You know, Cheryl, I stammered, I've never written a book. Neither have I, she replied. Dave Goldberg, Cheryl's brilliant and supportive late husband, saw the importance of the message, and together the couple carved out a way forward. Cheryl would write at night after the kids went to bed, pull back on social dinners, and devote vacation and weekend time to the book. I would also work nights and weekends, but my kids were older, so it was less of a strain. Researcher Marianne Cooper was recruited from the Clayman Institute for Gender Research to find and vet studies. The three of us all had day jobs and families, but we learned that while work expands to fill the time, time expands to fill a mission. In December, Knopf editor Jordan Pavlin, Jennifer, Cheryl, and I all met in New York. It was supposed to be a let's get the ball rolling meeting, but Cheryl arrived with a full outline and completed introduction. She'd been writing this book in her head for 20 years. It was an odd period of my life. As co-executive producer of Warehouse 13, I'd spend the day thinking up science fiction scenarios. Then at night, Cheryl would send me chapter drafts and we would iterate through another 20 or 40 drafts on the barriers that women face. These two worlds collided just once when I was fleshing out a lean-in section on queen bees, a term for women who attain status in a male-dominated industry and keep other women out. I wrote, unfortunately, this there can be only one attitude still lingers today. Sci-fi nerds will recognize this reference to Highlander, a 1986 action fantasy movie starring Christopher Lambert and Sean Connery that I've watched an embarrassing number of times. I figured the line would be edited out of the book, but it managed to survive, much like the Highlander himself. When reading the book in galleys, I realized Cheryl might not know the source of the quote, so I sent her an email and included the film clip. She wrote back that she had not gotten the reference, but it was fine to leave in. Lean In is the book that I wished I'd read at 25, not helped write at 52. It acknowledges that we need better institutional and governmental policies to support and protect all women, especially single moms. We need equal pay, more affordable child care, better parental leave policies, more sponsorship, and greater awareness of implicit bias. The book also looked at the internal barriers that can hold women back and urged women to sit at the table, raise their hands, take risks, and seek leadership positions. The hope is that once more women become leaders, they will be in a position to spur faster change for all. For women to lean in at the workplace, men need to lean in to their families. Even with parents who both have full-time jobs, moms do about 40% more childcare and almost 30% more housework than dads. This prompted Cheryl to advise women that the most important career decision you will ever make is choosing who your partner is. I nailed that one. Still, it hurt my stomach to work on a section about negotiation. I got it so wrong. My instinct had been to prove my value by listing my personal contributions to a project. That strategy works fine for men who can self-promote with impunity, but women are expected to be nice and communal. In October 2012, Cheryl hit send on a final draft to the editor. It had been an intense 9 months, and we both had our first weekend off in a long time. My plans included seeing a movie with my family and yoga. I didn't expect to hear from Cheryl, so I was surprised when my phone rang that Sunday morning. "I couldn't sleep last night," Cheryl said, sounding more excited than tired. "I want to start a nonprofit to go with the book that would help support women. I've already written the mission statement. Can I send it to you?" Her mission statement turned into leanin.org, which now hosts a community of over 1.5 million and provides materials for creating small support groups called circles. These circles truly help members ask for promotions, dump unsupportive partners, and be more ambitious. We hoped the launch of the book would change lives. On a personal level, it already had. I'd always been a feminist, but relied on my actions to speak louder than my words. Now I was broadcasting my beliefs, and it was awesome. After a life spent trying to break into boys' clubs, where I endlessly had to justify my worth, I was welcomed with open arms into a new club. Cheryl introduced me to her League of Extraordinary Women. I met Melody Hobson, the president of Ariel Investments, who inspired us both with her declaration that she wanted to be unapologetically a woman and unapologetically black. I met Joanna Coles, the funny and formidable editor of Cosmopolitan, who is the universal big sister. And thanks to Cheryl, I met Gloria Steinem, the Gloria Steinem. I'd grown up fascinated by the founder of Ms. Magazine, so it felt surreal to sit in a small room with her and Cheryl as they discussed global issues. Gloria had just returned from India and had horrifying stories to relay. "There are 8 million missing girls in India," she said. "Gone." Cheryl, who has spent time in India, nodded knowingly. "What do you mean?" I asked. "From the age of 1 to 5, girls are almost twice as likely to die as Indian boys," Gloria replied. "Why do you think that is?" I didn't know. I shook my head. "When girls get sick, their families don't value them enough to seek medical attention or pay for treatment." My heart sank. Gloria and Cheryl continued to talk about enslaved women until Cheryl got called away. Alone with Gloria, I felt queasy. Suddenly, I blurted out my existential angst. "I can't believe I care about getting women hired on late-night TV when that's going on in India." Gloria leaned forward and placed a hand on my arm. "Oh, no. You worry about late-night TV. I'll worry about India," she said. She delivered this advice with a little smile. She knew it sounded flip, but her point was profound. Gender bias is everywhere, and we need man-to-man, pardon the expression, defense on each front. We all need to speak up as much as we can with the specific influence we have. I've seen how women advocating for other women in late night can make a difference. When Jimmy Kimmel Live moved from 12:30 a.m. to 11:30 p.m., ABC Entertainment President Ann Sweeney took an interest in adding more women to the staff. Head writer Molly McNierney, the only female writer on Kimmel at the time, reached out to me to get names of women who might want to submit packets. I compiled a list and encouraged Bess Kalb, a sly and hilarious writer at Wired Magazine, to give it a shot. Dozens of other funny women applied. Stand-up Nikki Glaser was on my list, but passed to focus on her performance career. The night before submissions were due, Nikki emailed me. "Nell, I mentioned to a writer friend of mine last week that I was considering getting a packet together for you guys. She said that she was going to try to put something together as well and have some manager who is hip-pocketing her submit her. Now that guy is playing dumb and saying he can't get it to the right people. I know it wasn't my place to spread the word about this, and that wasn't my intention in this case, but she just emailed to ask if I could help in any way. She worked really hard on it, and I think she's a very talented writer. So I'm including it in this email, and of course you can do what you like with it, but I just wanted to at least do my best as her friend to get it to the right people. Thank you, and I'm truly sorry if this breached any confidentiality. Nikki." If women who don't help women get a special circle in hell, I think women who do help women should get a special cloud in heaven. Thanks to Nikki, Joelle Bukai's packet made it to the show. And thanks to Anne and Molly, both Joelle and Bess were hired and have worked at Jimmy Kimmel Live for more than 5 years. In 2013, Lori Kilmartin suggested I check out the Twitter feed of Jill Twiss, who made quirky observations like, "I'm just going to say it, bananas are clicky," and "pretty worried for gluten-free pigeons." I messaged Jill to learn more about her. During the day, she tutored kids for standardized tests and moonlit as a stand-up comedian and actress. When Last Week Tonight began staffing up, Tim Carvel asked for names and I mentioned Jill. That show reads submissions blind, removing any identifying details about the writer. Out of about 100 submissions, Jill was one of 8 people hired. She now has more Emmys than I do. Although, to be fair, anyone with one Emmy has more Emmys than I do. Last Week Tonight also hired Julie Wiener, who was working at Vanity Fair. Julie's blog pieces cracked me up, and I emailed her with the same comment that I heard at roughly the same age. "I really think you could write for television." Unfortunately, my system for tracking down funny female writers isn't methodical. It's mainly based on word of mouth, which can cast a limited net. I always wished that I could help more women, and especially women of color. In an ideal world, awareness would lead to action, which would lead to change. But in the real world, awareness more often leads to defensiveness, which leads to excuses. Emboldened by the forward motion in Late Night, I called a showrunner who ran a popular sitcom with a huge staff and only one female writer. We knew each other socially, so I thought he'd be open to a discussion. I got as far as my observation that his staff had a gender imbalance before hitting a nerve. "How dare you accuse me of being sexist?" he said. "My mother was the breadwinner in our family, and my wife is one of the strongest women on the planet." I tried to salvage the phone call. "I didn't call you sexist. But just look at the numbers on your staff. You think I don't notice?" he said, ire rising. "I look around the room and notice it every single day." This showrunner bringing up his breadwinner mother and strong wife is a perfect example of moral licensing. Everyone, male and female, is biased. But no one wants to admit it, so our brains search for examples that disprove the accusation. Moral licensing comes into play when people rely on past behavior to dismiss current prejudiced behavior. This is better known as the "some of my best friends are" defense. People who believe they are unbiased turn out to be more biased, so it's not enough to be aware that there's a lack of women in the room. You must also be aware that your knee-jerk defensiveness is part of the problem. When you're used to privilege, the saying goes, equality feels like oppression. My showrunner friend felt under attack, and our call ended on a sour note. I was angry with myself for coming on too strong. On the plus side, it taught me what not to do. It would be so helpful if blurting out, "Obviously there's a problem, so just fix it," worked. It doesn't. Ask anyone fighting climate change or gun violence where the stakes are life and death. Reshaping our culture means reshaping ourselves. We're raised in a biased culture, and that sinks into our psyches in ways that are hard to escape. A few weeks after the release of Lean In,
Cheryl's friend Michael Linton threw a backyard book party for her in L.A. It was a fun, festive occasion, and at one point, a young woman approached me. "Would you sign my book?" she asked. Without thinking, I waved my hand. "Oh, you don't want my signature," I said. "It's Cheryl's book." She looked at me strangely. "Please?" I signed her book, feeling a little freaked out by my reaction. I had just spent 8 months co-writing a book encouraging women to own their success. So why was I backing away from taking any credit? I thought of inscribing the young woman's copy with, "Man, this shit is deep." Instead, I wrote, "Don't skim." The next day, I emailed Cheryl to tell her about the exchange because it was such a perfect example of how women are socialized to downplay our achievements. Within seconds, Cheryl emailed me back. "You know, there's this great book you should read." Chapter 17. Lily Tomlin, the Kennedy Center, and a surprise guest. Jane Fonda celebrating Lily Tomlin at the 2014 Kennedy Center Honors. And no one is more loyal. You get Lily, you have her for life. Like with her cosmically brilliant collaborator and spouse, Jane Wagner. They've been together for 43 years. I don't know what that's like, but it sounds terrific. It took a couple of years, but speaking out about the lack of gender diversity in late night went from being one of the scariest things I'd ever done to one of the best. It put me on the path to Cheryl and Lean In, and my fear that CBS would never hire me again proved wrong. In the fall of 2014, Tim Carvel gave my name to writer Lewis Friedman, who emailed me to say that he was looking for someone to help with the CBS special, The Kennedy Center Honors. Now, normally, I don't work on such classy shows, but it seemed worth a follow-up. Lewis explained that year's honorees included Sting, Al Green, Patricia McBride, Tom Hanks, and Lily Tomlin. The executive producers were specifically looking for a female writer to help with Lily's tribute. Was I interested? I said yes so fast I sprained my tongue. Lily had been part of my life since I was 9. Most of Rowan and Martin's laugh-in went over my head, but I loved Lily's character Edith Ann, a little girl who sat in an oversized rocking chair and had a lot of opinions. She'd end her monologues with, "And that's the truth," and then stick out her tongue and make a fat raspberry. Lily moved from TV to movies, appearing in 3 of my all-time favorites, Nashville, All of Me, and 9 to 5. Lily also appeared on Broadway playing a dozen different roles in The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, written by her now spouse, Jane Wagner. I'm still laughing from lines like, "I worry about things like, if peanut oil comes from peanuts and olive oil comes from olives, then where does baby oil come from?" The Kennedy Center Honors had already booked Jane Fonda, Jane Lynch, and Reba McEntire for Lily's salute. Dolly Parton was unavailable. Executive producers, George Stevens Jr. and his son, Michael Stevens, considered adding one more performer. We batted around ideas over the phone. Sarah Silverman? Sketch gods Key and Peele? "You know who'd be great?" I said. "Kate McKinnon." "Who?" I explained that Kate was a cast member on Saturday Night Live and had just received her first Emmy nomination. "Does she have a connection to Lily Tomlin?" someone asked. "I don't know, but she plays Justin Bieber and Angela Merkel with equal ease, so I'm guessing yes." They sent me on a fact-finding mission. A few phone calls later, and Kate McKinnon was excitedly telling me how much Lily Tomlin meant to her. "My mom talked about Lily throughout my childhood," Kate said. "She gave me the book, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life, and said, 'You're going to need this,' like she was giving me a map. I read the book 200 times. When I finally saw the video of the stage show, I was like, 'This is what I want to do.' I thought it was the best thing I'd ever seen. It's not a caricature.
She's inhabiting those people and makes you really feel for them. That's the standard for sketch characters. She created the field. The producers worked out the details for Kate's appearance, and Lewis and I started shaping Lily's tribute. It would open with Jane Lynch performing one of Lily's most memorable monologues. "I'm Lucille, and I'm a rubber freak." Lewis had a fun idea of putting Kate in an Edith Ann rocking chair. She could do some physical comedy, sliding off the chair in her evening gown. Reba would talk about Lily's authenticity. Jane Fonda would talk about their deep friendship that started in the 70s. I assumed that the tribute would conclude with Reba singing a rousing version of Dolly's massive hit 9 to 5, but when I asked about it, the executive producer said Lily's tribute didn't need to include music. I wrote an impassioned email to try and change their minds. I can't say enough about how meaningful the movie 9 to 5 was and still is. It changed the world. 9 to 5 helped launch a union, Service Employees International Union, and became an anthem for feminism. Every woman connects with it. It's both emotional and rousing. One last thought. How great would it be to have Sarah Silverman, Reba McEntire, and Kate McKinnon walk out on stage from an elevator door, dressed like the characters from 9 to 5, to Dolly's thumping vamp? Laughs, applause, chills. Yeah, that didn't happen. The producers wouldn't budge on adding the song. Stephen Colbert was set to host the honors and had his own writers working on an opening monologue. Documentary filmmaker Sarah Lukensen was crafting mini bios of all the honorees. Lewis and I were responsible for intros, transitions, and generating additional material for speakers. Since Lewis lives in New York City, we collaborated through email and over the phone. We'd convene in D.C. right before the show. 2 days before my flight, Lewis called. "Hey, I thought you should know this," he said. "David Letterman just narrated the Hanks film." "Okay," I said. "A beat." "That means he'll be appearing on the show, and we need to write some jokes for him," Lewis explained. Adrenaline surged through my body. I didn't expect to ever cross paths with Dave again. My mind started spinning. Would he remember me? Had he read the article? Did he hate me? He probably hated me. "Since you've written for Dave before, why don't you do a first set of jokes?" Lewis said. I couldn't respond. I was too busy having a mini panic attack. "You'll be great at that," Lewis added. That's a wonderful boss. Lewis knew my history with late night and sensed my shaky mood. By giving me a task and encouragement, he refocused me on the work. I started at the beginning, brainstorming an entrance for Dave. The same way a good architect examines the physical landscape before designing a building, a writer examines the cultural landscape. I usually ask myself, what is the audience thinking when that person walks on stage? In Dave's case, there was one major event on everyone's mind. That spring, Dave had announced that he was stepping down after more than 30 years on TV. This announcement triggered roughly 50,000 blog pieces about how CBS should replace him with a person of color or female host. A week later, Stephen Colbert was handed the baton. After the announcement in April, Colbert stopped by The Late Show to chat with Dave, but the hosts hadn't been seen together in over 6 months. An idea popped into my head. I emailed Lewis with the subject line, "Funny idea?" On December 2nd, 2014, at 2:13 p.m., Nell Scovell wrote, "Have Letterman start the show, and then Stephen comes in and says, 'I'll take over.'" 2:34 p.m., Lewis Friedman wrote, "Ha, ha, 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 ha." 2:38 p.m., Nell Scovell wrote, "One way or another, we should engineer them together on stage. That's the money shot. Alternatively, Stephen could start the Tom Hanks tribute, and Dave interrupts and says, 'This is my job, not yours yet.'" 3:36 p.m., Lewis Friedman wrote, "Announcer, voiceover. Ladies and gentlemen, 2012 Kennedy Center Honors winner,
David Letterman. Letterman walks to the stage right lectern. As he's about to speak, Stephen Colbert enters, walking right up to him. David Letterman, not yet! Colbert sheepishly exits. At 6:38 p.m., Nell Scovell wrote, yes, that's all you need to do and it would get such a big laugh. This was our complete email exchange, and it shows the way a notion can quickly refine into a bit. When I arrived in D.C., Lewis told me that Colbert had approved the not yet beat. We just needed to get Dave on board. Lewis sent an email to Tom Keeney, Dave's point person, along with the opening and a couple of pages of jokes. Tom is chief strategy officer at Rubenstein Communications and one of the most brilliant PR reps around. If Tom had been captain of the Titanic, he would have convinced the iceberg to move out of the way. I was sitting at a desk next to Lewis when Tom wrote back. Lewis read the email out loud. Tom thanked us for the jokes and said Dave was jotting down some of his own. Oh, and they liked the opening. Yeah, I said. Lewis paused. Well, that's interesting, he said in his normal deadpan. What? Tom asked me a question about our meeting with Dave tomorrow. Now it's just going to be you and the producer in the room, right? Lewis stared at me. Do you think he recognized my name? I said. Lewis kept staring. Of course. Tom's job was to protect his client. This news didn't upset me since the thought of sitting across a table from Dave filled me with anxiety. As I was convincing myself that it was all for the best, Lewis typed a response and hit send. I just emailed him back, he said. What did you say? That you were working on the show and would be in the meeting. Again, that's a wonderful boss. The next morning, I asked a friend who knew Dave well for guidance. I think I'm going to see Dave today on this Kennedy Center honors thing. Yikes, he scares me, I wrote. My friend wrote back immediately. Just remember, his first thought about everyone is, they hate me. If you just smile and say hi and keep going, it will be a relief. I took my friend's advice and half a beta blocker to keep my heart rate down and minimize sweating. Lewis, some assistants, and I were in a rehearsal hall when Tom Keeney entered, followed by Dave. I jumped out of my